Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the special congressional election today for Ohio's 12th district, in which Republican State Senator Troy Balderson is trying to hold onto a seat the GOP has held for three decades. And since President Trump held a rally for him in the district on Saturday, the race is seen as an indicator of Trump's popularity and ability to help or hurt Republican candidates and whether the Democrats' blue wave materializes in November. Bob Fitrakis, a professor of political science at Columbus State Community College and editor of the Free Press newspaper, published widely on Ohio electoral politics, joins us. We'll discuss the national focus on this special election and efforts by Republicans to blunt the momentum of the Democratic challenger, Danny O'Connor, who is even in the polls, with a win for him tonight following a strong victory for the same seat in 2016, which the GOP won by 37 percentage points, surely being a big boost for the Democrats and a rebuke for Trump. But whoever wins, the whole exercise will have to be repeated in November with the same matchup between the two candidates. Then we'll speak with Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics, and folkloric ambivalence across media. The co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online, we will discuss the removal of Alex Jones's InfoWars content from Apple, Facebook, YouTube, and Spotify for peddling hate speech and false information online, and a new poll from Ipsos that finds that 43% of Republicans want to give Trump the power to shut down media that they say that they consider is engaged in bad behavior. Then finally, we'll assess the effectiveness of the expensive efforts underway to fight out-of-control fires in California that are expected to burn for the rest of the month. Mike Flanagan, a professor in the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta, joins us to discuss Trump's idiotic tweets blaming the California wildfires on Governor Brown for allowing water to be diverted into the ocean. We will also examine the real problem increasing the frequency and intensity of fires, which Trump is making worse by denying the science and existence of climate change. And joining us now is Bob Fitrakis, a professor of political science at Columbus State College, Community College, and editor of the Free Press newspaper, which is published widely on Ohio electoral politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Fitrakis.
Glad to be here.
Well, thanks, Bob. And you're at a viewing party in the district. So is there anything to report at this point on this race between the Democrat O'Connor and the Republican Balderson?
Yeah, but it's to be expected that Danny O'Connor is up a little over 20 points. But all of that is the early voting, where there was a significant higher turnout among Democrats than Republicans.
So, but that's the point, isn't it? If there's a higher turnout with Democrats, then there's likely to be an upset, right?
Correct. Well, everyone's predicting it's going to be a close race. Some polls have, depending on the turnout, have said that O'Connor could win by 10 if the Republican turnout is low and the Democrats high, or Balderson if there's been a re-energizing of the campaign from the Trump visit could win as high as 16. But right now the numbers are looking good for O'Connor just because of the huge early voting lead by the Democrats.
So the in what part of the what county are we talking about in terms of early voting? Because my understanding is that the counties around Columbus are much more urban and suburban and more likely to swing Democrat, whereas the rural counties will probably stay Republican.
Yeah, it's the early voting, what we're seeing is really from Franklin County and Delaware. And Franklin County is the county Columbus is in, And the area there, there's a very strong sliver of progressive Dems that were gerrymandered into this district to dilute them from voting in a adjacent Republican district. And a lot of it is the country club Republican areas, some of the most wealthy and affluent areas of Ohio, New Albany, Dublin, with its famed golf course, Muirfield. And these are the people, the Republicans, that have never embraced Trump. But you get into some of the outlying rural areas, actually, where Trump is very popular. That will be a test on the voter turnout there, places like Marion County and Richland County and cities like Mansfield and Marion, Ohio. So that's the real test. Those areas actually voted higher for Trump in 2016 than expected. But in some odd ways, Obama had done fairly well in the medium-sized former industrial cities.
So this is the seat that Governor John Kasich held, right, for the longest time.
Yeah, and for full disclosure, I ran against John Kasich in 1992 in the 12th district.
Right. Well, apparently you didn't win, right?
No, but they told me I would have done better if I'd have stayed out of Delaware County.
So, what does it say then that that we're even talking about a possible?
Well, there's only been two representatives since 1983. Only John Kasich and his key aide, Pat Tiberi, have represented that district.
Right. And Tiberi won by 37 points, didn't he not, in the last election?
He did indeed. That was considered a lock, a very easy gerrymandered, Republican district. So the fact that the polls are, showing it very close within a margin of error really tells us about this shift of these. It's very affluent in Delaware County and particularly in the Franklin County area. I mean, these are very middle class, upper middle class, and some very wealthy Republican suburbs. And many of these people are loyal to John Kasich, who, as you well know, is in the middle of a political spat with Donald Trump. In fact, there was one around his visit here. Kasich went public that Troy Balderson claimed he didn't invite Trump in. So you've got the governor who comes out for Troy Balderson, the state senator, the Republican candidate, going public and saying he didn't really want Trump to visit. He didn't really invite him in. And then you have Balderson kind of backpedaling, saying, well, that's not exactly what I said.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a big question about Trump. And I guess it'll be decided tonight to some extent whether he hurts or helps Republicans. The conventional wisdom is that he helps Republicans in the primaries because he's backing the more extreme candidates, the Tea Party mm-hmm. types. But in the general, those candidates will be less electable. And that of course, applies to the race that will have the results later from Kansas with Chris Kobach, the conservative Secretary of State, who served on this bogus commission that Trump set up to justify his claim that 5 million illegal Hispanics voted for Hillary Clinton. The polls don't close there till 9 p.m. So, again, I'm speaking with Bob Petrakis, who's a professor of political science at Columbus State Community College and editor of the Free Press newspaper, who has published widely on Ohio electoral politics. So the fact that that this seat was won by 37 points and is now up for grabs is in itself pretty interesting. But tell us about this guy, Danny O'Connor, the Democrat. Where does he stand in terms of this sort of you know, the bipolar nature of the Democratic Party? Is he on the Bernie side or on the sort of, you know, what do you want to call it, the conventional or Democratic establishment, I guess, is the way it's described?
Well, Danny O'Connor is interesting because there actually was a battle within the Democratic Party between the more progressive forces around Bernie, some that were opposed to the Clinton-Pelosi wing of the party. And O'Connor, who's a relative newcomer, was elected county auditor by beating out the more progressive forces. So in Franklin County, you know, there's a war going on within the party itself over who's going to be on the central committee and what the policies are. So he's with, you know, the although he did run commercials attacking Pelosi and calling for new leadership, even though he's with that wing of the party. He has run, you know, to the right of center. He has repeatedly invoked the name of John Kasich and talked about what a wonderful man he is. So that's part of the strategy that made it a toss-up, is O'Connor, you know, clinging to John Kasich and denouncing Nancy Pelosi, even though he was elected as a relative unknown just recently for county auditor in Franklin County by being tied to the kind of Clinton-Pelosi wing of the party.
So obviously that's pretty similar to what Conor Lamb did, right, in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it's going to be interesting if these people end up in the House, how they'll – and if the House flips to Democrats, how they'll get on with Nancy Pelosi. I don't think she's going to step down, do you?
No. He did backtrack on Hardball there when he was asked. He said he would ultimately vote for whoever the Democrats put up without mentioning. But he did actually run a commercial attacking her and calling for new leadership. It's been one of the themes of his campaign.
So when you said that the Democrats have been sort of gerrymandered into sort of running against each other, is that the case? Because that's what happened with Marcy Kaptur and Dennis Kucinich, right? They gerrymandered them. Is that the same seat we're talking about?
No. What they did is they eliminated Dennis Kucinich's seat in the Cleveland area by, it's what we call the snake on the lake. They created this really bizarre district that sort of tried to cut Kucinich out and went all along Lake Erie and then picked up Kaptur's, most of Kaptur's old seat. And as a result of that, what they did is created a new seat in the Columbus area, the third congressional district, which is essentially a African-American dense pack district where all the black areas of Franklin County, you know, city of Columbus, about 27-28% black, were dense back into one congressional district with other heavily Democratic areas like the campus area and the Old Town East area of the city. So that was actually a new district they created, which then allows two Republican districts to exist in Franklin County. So Franklin County, which voted 58% for Obama and voted for a majority for Hillary Clinton, is represented by three representatives, two of them Republican, who have all these attached suburban areas and then all these rural counties that are attached as well.
Well, that's an illustration of the great challenge that the Democrats face because of gerrymandering. They have to win between 7 and 8% more votes just to break even. And I keep repeating this, but it's worth repeating, that in the last midterm elections, only one-third of registered Democrats showed up to vote. So what you're telling us, Bob Fitrakis, that's happening on the ground now in Ohio, is at least people seem more motivated to vote. And even though this is a primary, a special election, mm-hmm. And whoever wins will only serve for a couple of months, right? And they'll have to do it all over again in November.
Correct. And really, on a hardcore partisan level, there's only about a 16% difference in the district based on Democrats to Republicans. The problem that 16%, with incumbents running like Pat Tiberi for years or Kasich, the Dems really never put much effort into really attempting to win that district. So that's why it goes up to 37%. But you absolutely have to overcome a party ID of around 16% that favors the Republicans. But that could be possible. I mean, the reason it's a toss-up are these, country club Republicans who love John Kasich and really sort of seem to, on some levels, despise Mr. Trump and his nationalism.
So how is the effort to unseat the Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown going there with, Jim Renacci?
Yeah.
So what are the chances there? I thought that Sherrod Brown was pretty popular, and he's even being talked of as a possible presidential candidate for the Democrats.
Well, yeah, Sherrod Brown, they keep throwing people at him, and he keeps beating them back every 6 years. And again, he's a progressive, and in many ways he's an economic populist. And he was, as was Marcy Kaptur, and again, our paper, the Free Press, endorsed him on this issue. They were both opposed to NAFTA, but in a progressive way. You know, they were calling for continental minimum wages and continental environmental standards, you know, for all of North America. So Sherrod Brown has the type of credentials, I think, much more legitimate on the issues like fair trade and NAFTA, more so than Trump does. And I think that's what will get him through in Ohio.
Well, as we started out, the polls did close about, 45 minutes ago in Ohio. Any updates? You're at a viewing party there, a poll-watching party. What would you call it, an election night party?
Yeah, just people gathering to
right.
watch the election.
Anything to report since?
Other than it's still following the line of the early voting. And the interesting thing is that a lot of these counties vote on DREs here. And actually, there was a lawsuit in the primary by a far-right, more Trump supporter over how the recount was done. There was actually a recount, and there's a suit by the very right-wing Republican woman who lost the primary because of what she said looked like funny results in Troy Balderson's core base. So it'll be interesting to see when these counties report. Theoretically, Franklin County should report last, or Delaware counties, but if these rural counties come in late, it could be interesting because some of those could go overwhelmingly towards Balderson.
Well, the other races to watch, and again, the polls don't close till 9 p.m. Eastern in Kansas, and the same in Michigan and in Missouri. The polls closed about 20 minutes ago. Nothing happening there, at least in terms of any information. And Washington State, of course, doesn't close till 11 p.m. Eastern. So at this point, we can report that O'Connor is well ahead, but it doesn't really mean anything, right?
Yeah, and again, people need to understand that those early votes, which are public records, they can begin counting them, 19 days prior to the election, are already factored into the polls.
I see. So, but it still looks like a very tight race, and it could be an upset for the Republicans and particularly for Donald Trump.
It could be. I mean, the feel on the ground, you know, it was a very nasty, you know, vicious one, but they were arguing over, you know, who was nicest. Both of them ran ads with their mothers, and, you know, one saying that, you know, he wanted to make sure as a Republican his mom would have health care, and the other one saying my mom was, you know, going to be cut from health care, et cetera. So this could be interesting, but if there is anything, I mean, Trump came in, but they actually had to move the location well out into the almost rural area of the county to avoid the large counter demonstrations. So if there looks like there's a tremendously motivated Democratic base with widespread, you know, on the ground canvassing. So if Danny O'Connor does pull it off, you know, it will be because of the door-to-door and the massive canvassing efforts and the Dems coming out in what appears to be a record number in a special election.
Well, Bob Fotrakis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Bob Fotrakis, who's a professor of political science at Columbus State Community College and the editor of the Free Press newspaper, who's published widely on Ohio electoral politics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking about misogyny and trolling and hate and online ethics, or the lack thereof. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics, and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She is the author of This Is the Way We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And her latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Whitney Phillips.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Whitney. And just before we get into your article at The Guardian, How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory, a new public opinion survey conducted by Ipsos has just revealed that 43% of Republicans want to give Trump the power to shut down media that they don't agree with. So apparently Trump's demonizing of the media, or particularly the New York Times, CNN, The Washington Post, and MSNBC, as the enemy of the people, is working.
Well, yeah, and that's what makes fact-checking efforts and media traditional media literacy efforts so difficult, that under perfect conditions, if there were a false narrative that were circulating social media, all media companies would need to do is say, this is false. Their QAnon is not a real thing. This conspiracy does not exist. You don't need to be worried about it. And that would take care of the problem, that that information would be corrective of false belief. But as it is, there is such a profound mistrust of mainstream news organizations that in some circles, simply by fact-checking a story, by debunking a particular story, that could reaffirm or further entrench that idea in the minds of someone who automatically believes that everything the New York Times reports is a lie. So that makes media literacy efforts that much more complicated.
But we are no longer a country where there is a consensus on what is real and what is true. Arguably, during the days of Walter Cronkite, when Uncle Walter delivered the news, there was a kind of consensus across the country. But since then, what seems to have happened is a kind of form of what they call reality shopping, where liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting. And this has had the effect of kind of balkanizing reality, if you like.
It has, yes. I mean, so one of the most profound shifts in the last generation, really, is the shift from singular media information gatekeepers to countless gatekeepers. You know, that it's not just that you have different realities being shopped by the likes of MSNBC or Fox News or whatever. What happens, you have a more complex feedback loop where you've got, you know, speaking of far-right extremists, you've got far-right extremists kind of kicking about certain ideas in these far fringe corners of the internet, but that bubbles up through Breitbart, and then what bubbles up through Breitbart filters in through Fox News and then sometimes gets tweeted about by the president, and that just entrenches that whole cycle. So you have multiple entry points for information, and then once that information enters a particular filter bubble, it can be very difficult to decouple or to challenge information that's not true, because it's kind of just bouncing around and becoming ever stronger the more times people share a particular idea.
Well, it seems that particularly these conspiracy theories, they don't really fall into any particular political category, because you have the left-wing media like this network, Pacifica, which promoted the 9/11 truther conspiracy with a film called Loose Change that was produced by none other than Alex Jones. And then you have right-wing media like Fox propagating the birther conspiracy.
Well, I mean, I would say that the current conspiracies that are being kicked around on social media, and particularly the QAnon conspiracy, that sort of began in these far-right corners, and then it enters. What is interesting about the filter bubble theory is that explains things up to a point. But after that point, it becomes more complicated, because even when you have sort of far-right fringe perspectives, wherever they might fall on the ideological spectrum, once they start getting reported by mainstream organizations, then that's when the ideas really become highly visible and prominent. One of the things that I discovered in research recently published by Data and Society, a research institute in New York City, is that it wasn't so much that you had a lot of content sort of mimetic play. It wasn't just that trolls and the quote-unquote alt-right, it wasn't just that they were pushing ideology into the mainstream. It was that mainstream journalists were repeating it. And it really got its strength from what is, well, depending on your perspective, I guess, these days, but more sort of center-left, centrist, mainstream organizations, that's where a lot of these ideas actually get their most, certainly their largest platform, and is where they become strongest. It's actually from the center, not from the fringes, as you might expect.
Well, I think the one thing in common on the fringes of both the left and the right in terms of conspiracy is a alienation from the government itself. And I always find that extraordinary. It may be connected to the fact that the world's most enduring democracy has about the lowest voting participation of all of the advanced democracies. And is that an explanation or a partial explanation? Alienation?
Although, you know, one of the most sort of puzzling analyses to come out of far-right conspiracies is that the Republican Party, the right wing, controls everything. So typically when you have conspiracies, yeah, it comes from the fringe, it comes from sort of variously underrepresented groups, at least ideologically underrepresented groups, and so people are sort of expressing their frustration by not being in positions of power, by, you know, sort of adhering to particular reality-affirming narratives that, you know, that make sense to them and that sort of help explain the world. And generally speaking, that's from people who are on the edges of the machine. But you have these, you, especially with the sort of deep state conspiracy theories, that's coming from the ultimate seat of power. So that's, conspiracies have always existed, and they typically have operated on the fringe. It's unusual and unique, and the people who study conspiracies in the U.S. in particular have commented on how unusual it is that the winning party is actually propagating some of these conspiracies, because that's just typically not how the pattern works.
And again, I'm speaking with Whitney Phillips, a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics, and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She's the author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And her latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. Well, I think to buttress the point that you just made, Whitney, it is, after all, the myth of the liberal media was something that the Republicans invented and they've been pounding on for decades. And it's obviously become a kind of touchstone of truth in those circles. And then, of course, the Christian right that has undue political influence in this country, they nevertheless portray themselves as beleaguered martyrs fighting a losing battle against secularism, etc., and the moral degradation of America, even though at this point they support a libertine president who lies prolifically and apparently pays off porn stars.
It's the human creature is quite an interesting creature indeed.
So let's focus on your article at The Guardian, How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. You say here that there's a symbiotic relationship between participating trolls and the news media. The fact that trolls need journalists to amplify their attacks, and that some journalists need trolls to give them sensational things to write about. Is that the sort of toxic compact that we're talking about here that propels this sort of rash of malign? I mean, the most extraordinary thing, again, I hate to keep talking about Trump, but here in California, you know, I can barely breathe the air in Los Angeles because of fires. Northern California is entirely on fire. And our president says it's to do with Governor Brown's water policies, where he lets all the water go into the Pacific Ocean and the firefighters don't have any water to put out the fires, which, of course, is ludicrously untrue. So I don't know where to begin. So let's touch on what you've posed here in your article about the symbiosis between trolls and journalists.
Well, I mean, yeah, and you could also talk about the symbiosis between journalists and Trump himself, although that's sort of a separate conversation, but not really. But one of the, so a pattern that I noticed when I started this work in 2008, which feels like 300 years ago, given everything that's happened, especially in the last few years, what was very striking and what I was actually studying was this relationship between these trolls who were deliberately trying to inflict emotional distress and cause the greatest sort of scandalous response as possible, and then journalists who covered them. So although I was studying trolls, I was actually studying that relationship between journalists and trolls, because both journalists and trolls ended up benefiting from trolls' misbehavior. Trolls benefited because they amassed what they refer to as lulls, which is a particular sort of antagonistic humor, indicating that the target has responded negatively, so that makes them laugh in a particular way. And journalists benefited because they would get advertising revenue and additional readers. I mean, for the last 10 years, you throw the word troll in a headline, and that almost guarantees you're going to get a lot of engagement. And so there's been some incentivization of continuing to write about trolls, and then, of course, trolls continuing to behave badly because all of their behaviors have proven to be so successful over time. So that was something that I established 10 years ago. And the troll space, as I have referred to it, it has changed considerably. The trolls that I was studying, they were definitely antagonistic, and they behaved in all kinds of, you know, racist and misogynistic and very problematic ways. But they didn't, they actually really rejected the idea of having a clear politics. So if somebody actually declared that they were far right or far left or anything, that would be grounds for that troll to be trolled by other trolls. And so trolls were not political in any kind of traditional way. They were privileged in their behavior, and it was politicized for sure, but they didn't declare themselves as being a member of a particular ideology. Over time, especially around 2015, there was a shift within those same spaces. More and more actual white nationalists who very proudly, you know, proclaimed an ideology, they started occupying those spaces. And so the troll space 4chan of 2008 is a very, very, very different place than where it is now. But those same rhetorical strategies and the same attempts to trick journalists into repeating a particular narrative or amplifying a story, the participants may have changed and their ideology may have changed, but those strategies have remained absolutely 100% constant for the last 10 years and even before that, because trolls were doing this several years before I started researching them. And so now, you know, you basically, it's watching the same story unfold over and over and over and over again, literally in my own perspective, in my own experience, for a decade. The same behaviors, the same coordinated manipulation strategies results in the same kind of coverage. And so, of course, they keep doing it because it keeps getting the attention that they want. And so you can't draw a very clear line between, you know, what happened on 4chan in 2008, but you really can look at these patterns and say, man, we need to start responding differently, because we just keep giving these manipulators and abusers exactly what they want and need, which is coverage and a national platform.
Well, you could make the case that Donald Trump is the ultimate troll. I mean, first of all, to address what you said earlier, the mainstream media gave Donald Trump about $5 billion worth of free advertising, which is probably why he won, if indeed you accept the idea that he won the presidential election, and the stuff that he tweets out on a daily basis. And also, his rallies have now become a focal point for people like QAnon to make themselves visible.
Yeah, that's a complicated... So over time, the word troll, when I was first researching this space, 4chan in particular, troll meant something very specific. It was a subcultural point of self-identification. That trolling was, it wasn't just what someone did online, it was who they believed themselves to be. It was an identity. And starting around 2010, 2011, internet culture, meme culture became more and more popular as a commodity. So you started seeing more and more advertisers employing trolling jokes and trolling references and trolling memes. And also the greater public became more and more exposed to and interested in trolling content. And so trolling kind of became diluted as a subcultural concept. And then journalists started using the word troll to describe more and more different kinds of behaviors until the word troll became really muddled. And back in 2008, if you said the word troll, it meant something very specific. Now, if you use the word troll, it could mean anything from being a Nazi or identifying with white supremacist ideology all the way to sort of teasing your friend in a harmless kind of a way. And I think there's a danger in collapsing those different behavioral categories because, for one thing, it's imprecise. And for another thing, it seems it accidentally equates violently bigoted antagonisms with, you know, play and humor, and we need to be able to differentiate those things because they warrant different responses. As it relates to Trump, I have really gone out of my way to not just avoid calling him a troll, but to really push back against that framing, because part of the problem with trolling is that it has this connotation of being somehow playful, that it's something that someone is doing on the internet, but it doesn't really have real-world consequences, and Trump may be outrageous, and he absolutely employs trollish rhetoric to gain the greatest amount of attention that he can. But what he does and what he says has profound embodied impact on countless individuals and groups of people. And so by referring to it as trolling, I think it might take away some of the teeth of the impact of what he does, and focusing on the bodies that are impacted, I think is really important and is sometimes lost when you use this word that has, you know, historically this connotation of sort of, we don't have to take it that seriously. Trump says all kinds of things, but what he says and what he does could not be more impactful in everyday people's lives, and I think it's really important to keep that in mind.
Well, I would think that trolls, going back to the kind of grim fairy tale idea of these creatures living under bridges, is they may be playful, but they're also scary. And I think it's the scary part that seems to be dominating. Just in closing, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Spotify have curtailed the influence of Alex Jones and his InfoWars content online. But at the same time, could you make the case that these giant tech billionaires in the Silicon Valley, who are the exemplars of the growing income disparity in this country, are they sort of heralding in a new kind of feudalism where content creators are like jesters in the court of King Zuckerberg?
Well, I've been highly critical of Facebook forever. And I think that the Alex Jones case, it gets confused, especially when people start, you know, bringing in conversations about free speech and different issues of censorship. All of those issues are important, and, you know, there's all kinds of risks involved and the slippery slope of who gets to decide who stays and who goes and who watches the watchers and all of that. But I think that the Alex Jones question, it also is a question of capitalism, that at a certain point, he was relevant, that was something that Facebook and Apple and Spotify, that was worth something to them. To keep him on the site, it was worth more to keep him there than to get rid of him. At a certain point, he became an economic liability to them. And so, yes, we need to have conversations about free speech and about censorship and all of these different kinds of things, but this idea that we're talking about capitalism, we're talking about corporations who make decisions not based out of morality, and Zuckerberg can say whatever he wants about free speech, that's fine, but they're making corporate decisions and they're also making legal-based decisions. They want to minimize their risk and maximize their profit, and so that is going to dictate or at least strongly influence the kinds of decisions they make around people like Alex Jones, which is not, you know, that's not heartening or anything like that, but it's also important to keep an eye on the corporate element of these conversations, which sometimes fall away when the focus is just on censorship and free speech issues.
Well, Whitney Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Whitney Phillips, who's a digital media folklorist who has spent a decade exploring trolling, hate, and misogyny online, online ethics and folkloric ambivalence across media, an incoming professor in the Communication and Rhetorical Studies Department at Syracuse University. She's the author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. And she's the co-author of The Ambivalent Internet, Mischief, Oddity, and Antagonism Online. And her latest article at The Guardian is How Journalists Should Not Cover an Online Conspiracy Theory. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back to discuss Trump's idiotic tweets blaming the California wildfires on Governor Brown. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Mike Flanagan, a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta in Canada. He worked as a meteorologist for a few years, then as a physical scientist, research scientist, and senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service. Dr. Flanagan's primary research interests include fire and weather-climate interactions, including the potential impact of climate change, lightning-ignited forest fires, landscape fire modeling, and interactions between vegetation, fire, and weather. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mike Flanagan.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you today.
Well, thank you, Mike. And, of course, here in Los Angeles now, the air is getting brown because of fires in Riverside County to the east of Los Angeles. But in the north of the state, the largest fire now, called the Mendocino Fire, apparently is so big and so out of control that it's expected that it will burn for the rest of August. And I've seen satellite images on television of the massive amounts of smoke coming out and drifting across to the east, across several states to the east of California. So Canada, of course, is subject to these kind of fires, but how unprecedented is this? And this is often said that we're early in the fire season.
So, yes, the last few years, California, around the world, we've seen devastating and deadly wildfires. And I think it's really important to understand the ingredients for fire. And whether you're in Canada or California or Greece, these are the three things you need for fires to occur. First is the fuels, the stuff that burns, whether it's chaparral or trees or the grass. How much you have, how dry it is, really important. Second, you need ignition. And, you know, it only takes a spark to get a fire going. Generally, there's two classes, people and lightning. And the third reason, and I may be biased, unabashedly biased, is weather. And I think weather is the most important. Hot, dry, and windy conditions are very conducive to fire. You get all three, you get a fire. But once you have the ignition, then it's really up to the fuel and the weather. And the thing that drives the fuel is, or the fire, is the fuel moisture. And the fuel moisture is a function of the weather. It depends on how dry it's been, how hot it's been. And you get all three, and you get fire. And fires are natural in many ecosystems around the world. But what happens is you get this intersection between fire and society with devastating results. And fire is the one that's always winning. You know, we've had this battle with fire, you know, firefighters, water bombers, wherever, you know, this military kind of style approach, attitude, mindset to fire. And it's not the enemy, but we've been treating it as an enemy, and we're getting our butts kicked. So we have to treat it as a natural process. And yes, definitely, there are unwanted fires. If a fire starts 2 kilometers away from Redding, California, it only takes a half second to say, that is a dangerous, unwanted fire. And the philosophy behind fire management for unwanted fires is you hit hard, you hit it fast. We call it initial attack. And a fire is the size of my office, which isn't very large, it's easy to put the fire out. But once the fire gets the size of a football field, and it's hot, dry, and windy, and the fuels are dry, now you have a real problem. So, and this window of opportunity put out can be as little as 15 minutes. And we're seeing that with the Holy Fire in near Los Angeles. You know, it grew very quickly, over 1,000 acres now. And, you know, that window of opportunity to put out is now gone because it's too large. And, you know, we see these iconic pictures of water bombers, planes dropping water or retardant on a fire, and you think it's putting the fire out. But when a fire is large and intense, it's like spitting on a campfire. You know, there's not much that can be done. I tease my American colleagues that you might as well be dropping wet paper dollar bills in the fire for as much good it's going to be doing. We don't have paper dollar bills anymore in Canada, so that's why the American context. But we're wasting money dropping things, retardant, water, on a high-intensity fire, because once they get that intense, we cannot put them out. So the opportunity is to wait for natural fire breaks, whether they're rivers or mountain ranges where there's no fuel, or man-made ones like highways and other areas where we can have a defensible space. Now, there is one more item in the toolkit. When I say that, you know, helicopters and planes dropping water and retardant aren't effective at stopping that fire, there's something called a backburn, which can be used very effectively. And the philosophy here is, so the wildfire is spreading with the wind, in the direction of the wind, and it's a high-intensity fire. You get in front of that wildfire, and you start a new fire, but it's backing into the wind, so it's a lower intensity fire that you can manage, and you start at a highway or some other break so you can keep it from spreading. And then the wildfire meets this back burn, and it runs out of fuel. And that's a way we can stop fires. The trick is that the wind cannot shift directions when you're doing this back burn, or that back burn could quickly flip to a head fire and then become high intensity, and then you have a real problem.
Well, in terms of problems, and you're suggesting, Mike Flanagan, that our solutions are largely cosmetic, seeing these big tankers dropping retardant, et cetera, may appear that something is being done, but you've made it pretty clear that it's pretty futile. But our president just tweeted out on Tuesday, California wildfires are being magnified and made much so much worse by the bad environmental laws, which aren't allowing massive amounts of readily available water to be properly utilized. It's being diverted into the Pacific Ocean. Must also tree clear to stop fire from spreading. Well, sounds like Trump is making a pitch for more logging. But then he goes and attacks the governor of California, Jerry Brown, saying Governor Jerry Brown must allow the free flow of the vast amounts of water coming from the north and foolishly being diverted into the Pacific Ocean can be used for fires, farming, and everything else. Think of California with plenty of water. Nice. Fast federal government approvals. Everybody is scratching their heads on that one, including people at the White House. Nobody at the White House will defend what the president has said. Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
Not a clue. It's mind-boggling. It really is. It's obviously someone who does not understand the basics of wildland fire, let alone the nuances. If I was to attribute, a cause to these fires, it's twofold. And first is climate change. Our climate is changing, and I would say it's because of human actions, because of all the greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere. And there's three reasons why a warmer climate is causing a larger fire problem. And that is because our fire seasons are getting longer here in Canada, as well as in California. It's now a year-round fire season in California. And I don't see that changing. Second, the warmer it is, the more lightning we see. And the more lightning we see, everything else being equal, the more fires we'll see. And the third reason is probably the most important. As the temperature increases, the ability to suck moisture out of the fuels increases almost exponentially. And what this means is that the fuels will be drier unless we see increases in precipitation. And we're not seeing that. And, projections into the future, and these are imperfect models, absolutely. But if they're anywhere close to reality, it's going to be a much warmer future and drier in parts of the United States and Canada. But this increased temperature means our fuels will be drier, which means that it's easier for fires to start and spread. And when they do start, they'll burn more of the fuel, so it burns more intensely, which means it's more difficult to put out. So that's the first side. Climate change has changed our fire regime. That's the characteristics of wildland fire that we see. Second is we're building and developing wildland areas so that we're getting this intersection between fire and society more often. So if you put more and more societal values on the landscape, whether it's industry or homes, and naturally occurring fires happen, you get some of these fires burning homes, unfortunately. And my heart goes out to people who've lost their homes, because it is very traumatic, and and some people it takes years to work through the loss of a home and all your possessions and being I'm not a social scientist, but I can just have empathy for people going through this rough period. So, we have people living and working in the wildland, what used to be wildland areas, and just these fires are now interacting with them more than they did in the past. So climate change and more people, industry on the landscape.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, fire officials say that 95% of all wildfires are caused by humans, and that could be anything from an unattended campfire, careless smoking, tossing a cigarette butt away, a spark from vehicles, and improperly maintained power lines. So that 95% is a pretty high statistic, right?
Yes, it does vary regionally and seasonally from place to place. There are a number of lightning fires that have been consequential, but mostly they're started by people. And, you know, so what can we do about wildland fire? Well, you know, I often go back to those three ingredients. We can't do anything about day-to-day weather, though globally we can do something about climate change, and we should be doing more. Ignition, we can't do anything about lightning, but we can, and we can do more about people-caused fires. And, you know, we have fire bans and various alert systems in place and education programs, but every human-caused fire is preventable. And, you know, last year, the Northern California fires, some of them were started by downed power lines. Well, you can bury power lines. And the response I got was, that's expensive. Well, the final bill for some of the Northern California fires aren't in, but we're talking $10 billion plus in insurable losses, let alone uninsurable losses. So, yes, it's expensive, but it's worth it. Or you can keep power lines above ground, but just design them to withstand strong winds, the Diablo winds or the Santa Anas in the south, and make sure that they're maintained so that there's no trees close to these lines that can blow into the power line, knock it down, and start a fire. So there are things we can do better to reduce the likelihood of a human-caused fire. Arson is a problem in some places, and enforcement of severe penalties for arson fires is one way. But we really have to do something about the way we respond to fire. Typically, in emergency management, you go through prevention, mitigation, preparedness, response, recovery, reviews, the process. In terms of the fire budget, we spend way too much in the response fighting the fire, and those other areas are underfunded. And, you know, just as an aside, recently there's been comments coming from the White House about reducing the budget for research, for wildland fire research. And this is just absolutely bonkers, is what I'll say, because right. We need research now more than ever.
Sure. Well, just in closing, though, Mike Flanagan, we ran out of time, but, you know, our ignoramus in chief in the White House is not just responsible for that. He's also responsible for denying climate change and doing everything he can to reverse what inadequate efforts have been made so far to deal with this threat to our planet. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Mike Flanagan.
Oh, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mike Flanagan, who's a professor with the Department of Renewable Resources and the director of the Western Partnership for Wildland Fire Science at the University of Alberta. He has worked as a meteorologist and then as a physical scientist and a research scientist and then a senior scientist with the Canadian Forest Service. And he works on the weather-climate interactions, including the potential impact of climate change, lightning-ignited forest fires, landscape fire modeling, and interactions between vegetation, fire, and weather. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.